There's a direct correlation between the openness of a country's economy and its standard of living. A study carried out by economist Jeffrey Sachs and the Harvard Institute for International Development found that openness was decisive for rapid growth. Open economies, Sachs reported, grew 1.2 percentage points per year faster than closed economies, controlling for everything else, because the more open you are, the more integrated you are into today's world network of ideas, markets, technologies, and management innovations. When I was visiting Jilin Province in northern China, monitoring village elections, one of the villages we toured was Kai'an, where we were able to see many villagers in their homes. Most of them were three-section homes. The first section was a small mud-brick hovel where the family lived under Mao. The second was a larger red-brick structure where the family lived under Deng Xiaoping. And the third, which was always the newest, was a white-brick structure with painted tiles around the front door. And it was built in the Jiang Zemin era. You could literally see, as China became more open as a country, the length of each villager's home grew. In the future, the virtues of keeping your economy as open as possible will only multiply, because in the era of globalization, knowledge is the key to economic growth. And if you close your country off in any way to either the best brains in the world or the best technologies in the world, you will fall behind faster and faster. That's why the most open-minded, tolerant, creative, and diverse societies will have the easiest time with globalization, while the most closed, rigid, uptight, self-absorbed, and traditional companies and countries, which are just not comfortable with openness, will struggle. University of California at Berkeley urban studies expert Annalise Saxenian has done a fascinating study entitled Regional Advantage, explaining what makes Silicon Valley so distinctive from most other high-tech beehives. What makes Silicon Valley unique, she concluded, are the extremely open boundaries that exist there among technology firms and between these firms and the venture capital community, the banking community, the university research community, and the local government. Saxenian points out that the Silicon Valley of the East Coast, Route 128 in Boston, has always lagged behind the real Silicon Valley because Route 128 was dominated by a culture of secrecy and self-sufficiency within firms and risk aversion within both the business and financial communities. Some small countries are catching on to the virtues of openness. The Washington Post reported October 17, 1997, that while immigration was becoming a flashpoint between conservative and liberal ideologies in the United States, other countries have decided to take a leaf out of the book of the American immigrant experience. Singapore's ambassador in Washington, Hung Chi Chan, has unveiled an initiative to attract immigrants to Singapore, urging them to go west, really west, far west, farther and farther west until they hit Asia. The ambassador was quoted as saying, "We recognize that we need more people to contribute to our vision for an intelligent city, a city of the future." The idea of seeking immigrants, she explained, stemmed from a survey of thriving societies such as the United States and Britain, which prosper because of their openness and diversity. "We discovered that societies that are open remain innovative and move on," said the ambassador. Therefore, Singapore was seeking cross-fertilization in the fields of information technology, engineering, pharmaceuticals, and research and development, as well as banking. "You will continue to see growth in these diverse countries," she said. "That is why Singapore is quite confident in recruiting talent." Singapore's labor recruiting program called Contact Singapore has already attracted young Europeans and Australians. The Singaporean ambassador said the salaries being offered are high and competitive with Silicon Valley. And yes, Singapore does have Brooklyn bagels. Singapore had Brooklyn bagels, but it didn't have the atmosphere of intellectual openness to really develop its own bagel, let alone cutting-edge software or internet-enabling technologies. Prime Minister Goh Chok Tong even declared in a national address in August 1999 that we have to create a Silicon Valley state of mind in Singapore, creative and willing to take risks. His government started to loosen up on its censorship of internet sites as a symbolic gesture in that direction. But the ruling party in Singapore still maintained a tight grip on information and politics in the country, one that created an atmosphere unlikely to attract and hold the best bagel or chip makers. Still, it is worth watching Singapore because of the way it has made the connection between intellectual freedom and openness and the ability to thrive in the internet age. That is a hopeful sign. As Lyric Hughes, the founder of China Online, once observed, if formerly restrictive regimes can be persuaded to see the free flow of information not as a threat to the power of sovereign states, but as the creator of a viable economic infrastructure and a population incentivized to take advantage of the new economy, the next century will be promising indeed. You will not only attract more brains when you are open, but also more technology transfers from the electronic herd. When a country has lower tariffs and trade barriers, it is a very important signal to the electronic herd, especially to the multinational companies, the longhorn cattle. Let's say you are Xerox and you have decided to build a plant in Brazil to make copiers. If Brazil keeps its copier market open and does not try to protect its own copier factories, Xerox will have a great incentive to transfer its top-of-the-line copier technology to its new Brazilian factory, because it can get competition in the Brazilian market from anywhere in the world, including the best Japanese and European copiers. But if Xerox knows that Brazil intends to maintain high tariff barriers to protect its own copier factories, Xerox may still open a factory there to compete in the Brazilian market, but it will be under no pressure to install its most cutting-edge technology in that Brazilian factory. Why should it, when it only has to compete against fledgling protected Brazilian companies? So Brazil ends up losing. Its workers, its market, and its consumers are deprived of exposure to the best technologies available. This is a true story. Brazil and Taiwan had roughly the same per capita income in the early 1980s, with lots of serious domestic companies, abundant capital, skilled workers, and well-trained middle management. They each decided they wanted to dive into the international electronics business in a big way, and in particular, the market for making fax machines. The problem was that the source of the best fax technology for both countries was the same, the Japanese company Fujitsu. The Brazilian Congress in 1988 imposed a broad range of tariffs on electronic products, including fax machines, in an effort to protect Brazil's infant fax industries. As a result, no one had an incentive to transfer to the Brazilian market their best fax technology. Taiwan announced zero tariffs and open competition for who could make the best fax machines. According to a World Bank study, by 1994, Taiwan was the leading manufacturer of fax machines in the world, while Brazilian fax machines cost far more than the world average and were on the verge of extinction. In 1995, the Brazilian Congress rescinded the tariffs on fax machines and decided to compete on an open standard. When China was accused in 1999 of having stolen some American nuclear warhead secrets, I was as upset as anyone, but not that upset. because America's most important secret is one that the Chinese can never steal. It is how we live. It is how we live as an open society. When you live in a closed society, there is always one more secret you have to steal to stay in the game, because there is always one new innovation you have to catch. It is not that closed societies can't innovate. It is simply that the chances of them doing it consistently are much, much lower. When you live as an open society, your strength comes precisely from that openness and the undying spirit of innovation and entrepreneurship it constantly nurtures. When the Chinese photocopy that, I will start to worry about them as competitors. Does your country or company dare to be open on the inside? It is not only critical in this era of globalization to learn how to compete without walls on the outside of your country, it is also critical to learn how to remove the walls inside. The more transparent you are inside, the more your government is grounded in the rule of law, the more you are willing to share how and where decisions are made, the less likely it is that corruption will remain hidden, and the more likely others will be willing to stick with you. An efficient, transparent, and honest legal system where citizens can get an accurate picture of how their government's policies are performing, and investors can be assured that private property and intellectual innovation will be respected, and the playing field will be relatively level, is essential for sustainable growth. Which is why Lyric Hughes, the founder of China Online, rightly argues that in the coming years we will no longer refer to developed and underdeveloped countries, or emerging markets and non-emerging markets. Instead, we will refer to transparent countries and non-transparent countries. Every economic decision will be global in the 21st century, argues Hughes. In a world of global capital markets, investment will flow to the regions that are transparent to the international financial community. The very term emerging market will soon be viewed as a quaint 20th century term to be replaced by a new worldwide paradigm of transparent and non-transparent economies. Looking into the future, developed markets such as Japan, which failed to create a free flow of information, and whose economic structures remain opaque to the outside world, will find themselves competing against formerly poor nations whose public policy environment favors transparency. Does your country's or company's management get it? And can you change management if they don't? Several years ago, I was interviewing the leader of an Arab country, and in the course of the interview, I complimented him on the fact that Moody's credit rating agency had just re-rated his country and boosted its credit rating from below investment grade to investment grade. This Arab leader thanked me for my congratulations and then turned to an advisor seated next to him and said in Arabic, "What is Moody's?" Management always matters, but in this more complex and fast-paced system, management and strategic vision matter a lot more. When I look at a country or company today, I ask, can the boss do information arbitrage? Can he or she be constantly synthesizing six different dimensions at once? Does he or she understand the three democratizations and have a strategy for how to take advantage of them? Because if you can't see the world, and you can't see the interactions that are shaping the world, you surely cannot strategize about the world. And if you are going to deal with a system as complex and brutal as globalization, and prosper within it, you need a strategy for how to choose prosperity for your country or company. Craig Barrett, the president of Intel, once remarked to me, "We are the biggest investor in Ireland, and I believe the biggest employer. We are there because Ireland is very pro-business. They have a very strong educational infrastructure. It is incredibly easy to move things in and out of the country, and it is incredibly easy to work with the government. I would invest in Ireland before Germany or France. France is the one country in the world that has outlawed the use of encryption for internet commerce. Encryption technology, which Intel is now building into its chips, is critical for internet commerce to prevent criminals from stealing credit card numbers and other personal data. France is the only country in the world where we can't take orders over the internet from our customers because we can't use encryption technologies, said Barrett. I was just in Paris to show off some new Intel products, and we had to get a special 24-hour written waiver from the French government just to demonstrate our encryption technology for this single marketing event. Most countries in the world would be terrified to know that the head of Intel thinks they're out of step. France thought Intel was out of step. You put in a silly rule outlawing encryption that you can already download from the internet, and you end up inhibiting the growth of your commerce and your economy, said Barrett. Either you allow me to encrypt at the cutting edge, or I go away. In the late 1980s, Intel was holding a Europe-wide marketing meeting, deciding where to put resources and figuring out which countries would be hot and which would not. The head of European marketing for Intel showed up at the meeting with a map of Europe. Only he had cut France out of his marketing map with a razor blade. It was such obtuse behavior that started me thinking that if France were a stock, I'd sell it. France is changing, though, and eventually I expect it will make an appearance on the buy list. While certain French government officials and intellectuals say a lot of silly things about and against the globalization system, French industrialists and entrepreneurs are putting on the golden straitjacket with a vengeance. France has even loosened up on encryption controls since Barrett was in Paris in 1998. When it comes to globalization, the French are like the driver who always signals left and then turns right. If you only read the French pundits in Le Monde, you would think France is never going to get it. But if you read the French business news in the European Wall Street Journal, you realize that their private sector elites get it quite well and are pushing France into the globalization system. Potent forces are fast undermining the French government's traditional influence on the economy. The Wall Street Journal Europe reported November 19, 1999. Privatized companies no longer exist to serve the state and provide jobs. They answer to a demanding bunch of international investors whose main concern is profits. At the same time, the growing clout of the European Union makes it increasingly difficult for French rulemakers to get their way. Unlike in the past, when government bureaucrats pulled many of the French economy's strings, a majority of today's mergers are cooked up by independent-minded corporate managers and ratified by investors scattered around the globe. There will be a steady backlash within France against this sort of corporate adjustment to the globalization system, but eventually the backlashers will lose. Not without a good fight, though. A friend of mine went to Paris in the summer of 1999, and she had to use the public internet facility at the central post office in Paris to send some email. She arrived around lunchtime, and when she got there, she found the internet room was closed. It was manned by a French bureaucrat, and when he went out to lunch each afternoon, he locked the door and put up a sign that said he was out to lunch. So, the good news is that the Paris post office is now offering internet services to the public. The bad news is that the room in which it is located still operates on 200-year-old French business hours and closes for 2 hours at lunch, as though it were a butcher shop. Another major country that is on my temporary sell list is Russia, which still has not put in place the operating systems and software to choose prosperity. The most graphic demonstration of that came in October 1999, when Russia's top stock market watchdog quit after declaring that Boris Yeltsin's government was simply not interested in enforcing laws to protect shareholders in Russia. Imagine if you picked up an American newspaper and found that Arthur Levitt, the head of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, had quit, saying that the New York Stock Exchange and American commercial courts were so corrupt that you were better off going to Las Vegas and putting your money on red or black than investing in the market. You need a whole different group of people at the top in Russia, remarked Bill Lewis, who heads the McKinsey consulting firm's Global Institute, which conducted a massive study of the Russian economy in the fall of 1999. Many people have pointed to the fact that Russia has consistently held free elections as a sign that it is basically going in the right direction. But the real question is, do Russians have people to vote for? Do they have politicians who understand what Russia needs today and are ready to implement it? The answer is no. What Russia needs most is their version of our Roosevelt. They need a shrewd, honest, savvy Paul who can attract the right technocrats around him and lead a democratic process to put in place the social policies and limited but enforceable regulations that are the necessary foundation for growth. I remain hopeful that, as in France, a new generation is slowly coming of age in Russia that understands the globalization system and will demand the instruments and governance to succeed within it. In November 1999, I attended a seminar on competitiveness in Colombo, Sri Lanka, organized by USAID. The audience was made up of Sri Lankan, Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, and Nepalese business leaders and economists. One of the keynote speakers was former Costa Rican President José María Figueres, who gave the audience an hour-long spellbinding description of how Costa Rica got intel to set up a factory in its country and successfully adapted to the information revolution. The audience of South Asians was awed, and when it came to question time, one questioner after another stood up and asked, "Would you run for president in our country?" It was the most striking scene. People from several different countries standing up and asking the former president of another to run for office in their homelands, and not being at all embarrassed. What this tells you is that as we enter this era when everyone increasingly knows how everyone else is living, especially the 30 to 40-year-old educated generation coming of age today in many countries, they are not going to tolerate bad political management forever. A 46-year-old Sri Lankan woman banker who attended the seminar with me expressed quite beautifully her frustration. "We have lost 25 years," she said. "In 1964, Lee Kuan Yew, the leader of Singapore, came to Sri Lanka and said Singapore should become like Sri Lanka. We were his model on literacy, on health care, on education. But now Singapore is the model, and ours is a destiny we never achieved. So when people listened to Figueres, they said, 'Why can't we get leaders like this? Where did he come from? How did he happen? Is it that people get the leaders they deserve? Have we done something wrong? We need to take all these leaders who are corrupt and bumbling and ostracize them. But we never do. There are so many people whose heads haven't rolled who should have.' No wonder," she added, "that so many people walked out after Figueres' speech and said, 'If we don't have that kind of competence within our own country, why can't we hire it?'" One of the big Sri Lankan businessmen said, "I wouldn't even mind paying his salary myself. The brains are here. Look at the number of companies that Sri Lankans or Indians have started in Silicon Valley. But we don't have the necessary leadership here to manage our own ship." Is your country or company willing to shoot its wounded and suckle the survivors? In a world without walls, your company or country has to have a culture that encourages the destruction of established businesses even while they still seem to be successful. Otherwise, somebody else will. Compaq got created precisely because IBM was not willing to destroy one of its own computer innovations, the IBM AT, based on the 286 chip, and jump ahead for a faster PC based on the 386 chip, as soon as that microprocessor was available. So Compaq came along and built the 386-based PC instead, and dealt a serious blow to Big Blue. As MIT economist Lester C. Thoreau points out in his book, Building Wealth, old big firms understand and often even invent the new technologies that transform the world, but they have a structural problem that is almost impossible to solve. When breakthrough technologies come along, such firms must destroy the old to build the new. Four of the five makers of vacuum tubes, for example, never successfully made transistors after transistors emerged to replace the vacuum tube. And the fifth today is not a player, notes Thoreau. When the microprocessor allowed the personal computer to replace the mainframe as the dominant growth market in the computer industry, the old industrial leader IBM fell off a cliff. Business Week, December 13, 1999, profiled Edward Zander, the hard-charging president of Sun Microsystems. One paragraph in that story jumped out at me. It read, "Having watched former employers Data General and Apollo Computer get creamed at the height of their success, Zander is launching his second makeover of Sun in 5 years. He's trying to create a new kind of company designed to be less about selling standalone computers and more about making websites, corporate networks, and handheld gizmos work without a glitch. We're going to break the company again," he says. "I want Sun to be the IBM of the Internet age." What goes around comes around. Because IBM also wanted to be the IBM of the Internet age, the industry leader. And increasingly enough, this time, IBM is making the transition. IBM has not only transformed itself into more of an Internet-based company, but it transformed its business into a full-service Internet clinic, where any company, large or small, can come to acquire the technology, support services, and advice for becoming an e-company or doing e-business. In other words, IBM went from being the industry leader to being the corporate equivalent of the Soviet Union to being one of the leaders again, by first inventing itself, then being unwilling to reinvent itself, and then by radically reinventing itself. By the year 2000, IBM was one of the leading Internet doctors and e-business solutions providers, giving Sun, Compaq, and all the others who seemed to overtake IBM in the 1980s and early 1990s a run for their money. Countries need the same culture of reinvention to thrive. As Thoreau again notes, societies that aren't ready to break with the past aren't willing to let entrepreneurs come into existence. Europe provides a good example of the importance of entrepreneurship. Europe saves and invests more than the United States, has a better educated populace, and has a basic understanding of science that is just as good as in the United States. Yet it has created none of the new brain power industries of the 21st century. Last year, 1998, the production arm of the last indigenous European computer manufacturer, Siemens Nixdorf, was sold to Acer of Taiwan. How can a region be a leader in the 21st century and be completely out of the computer business? The European entrepreneurs that should exist don't. Sociology almost always dominates technology. Ideas often lie unused because people do not want to use them. The fact that something is possible does not mean that it will happen. A society that welcomes or at least tolerates creative destruction has to be in place for revolutionary products to emerge. This is particularly crucial in a world without walls in which it is much harder to protect the old from the new. A country should worry about the loss of jobs, but not the loss of firms. That may seem contradictory, but it is not. If you worry about the loss of firms, you will end up losing a lot more jobs. You should have safety nets for people who lose their jobs, but not for firms that lose their edge. It is not an accident that Taiwan survived the Asian economic crisis of the late 1990s to a much greater degree than all its neighbors. The most important reason for this, argues Chi Shiva, vice chairman of Taiwan's Council for Economic Planning and Development, was the willingness of Taiwan's government to tolerate a culture of creative destruction. Part of this was an accident of history. When the nationalists came to Taiwan from the mainland during the Civil War in China in 1948, they took over the reins of government, but they did not take a great deal of interest in business. This was because they didn't plan on staying in Taiwan long. They assumed they would be going back to the mainland. So from the beginning, Taiwan's government had a much more of a hands-off approach to business than others in Southeast Asia. Instead of nurturing huge conglomerates, as in Korea or Japan, the Taiwanese government, relatively speaking, stayed out of the business world. The result was the emergence of a beehive of small and medium-sized enterprises that often began with one family working out of its living room. These businesses could only survive by being highly flexible and highly efficient, and by being ready to jump from business to business and market to market at a moment's notice. And because the Taiwanese government opened its economy in the 1980s and did not try to protect these small businesses, they were constantly exposed to the most competitive markets and technologies in the world. So they steadily accelerated automation, improved their product quality, moved into higher value-added goods, and relocated manufacturing overseas, even though it temporarily cost some jobs at home. Those who couldn't keep up were left as roadkill, or absorbed by better firms. Indeed, the Ministry of Economic Affairs in Taiwan proudly offers a statistic entitled Births and Deaths of Companies in Taiwan, 1986 to 98. Which shows a steady balance of new companies being created and old companies killed off, even during the Asian economic downturn. It isn't enough, though, to be willing to shoot your wounded and let the Darwinian process work in the marketplace. Successful countries, notes Shiva, are also those that have a venture capital mentality and community that can help identify winners and nurture them so that they can commercialize their innovations. Having a gambling culture such as Taiwan's really helps, because when an innovator comes up with a new idea in his garage, he usually finds it difficult to develop that idea because of the high risks involved. That is why small and medium-sized businesses such as those in Taiwan need venture capitalists ready to take high risks for high rewards. Taiwan's venture capital industry emerged in the early 1980s and by all measures has been a huge success, spawning hundreds of profitable firms. In Silicon Valley today, some of the most successful companies such as Cisco and Intel were initially nurtured by gambling venture capitalists. How good is your country or company at making friends? We have moved from a world where everyone wants to go it alone, where the rugged individualist is the executive role model, and the vertically integrated company that does it all is the corporate model, to a world where you can't survive unless you have lots of allies, where the Churchillian alliance maker is the executive role model, and the horizontally allied company is the corporate model. In a global economy, you cannot survive in certain industries unless you are able to compete on a global basis, and you cannot do this without alliances. It is easy to see why. In a number of industries, such as semiconductors, aerospace, telecommunications, and pharmaceuticals, notes Stephen J. Cobrin, the Wharton School expert on globalization, The scale of technology has grown to the point where even industry leaders may not have the resources to mount a competitive R&D effort alone. Given the enormous costs involved, the uncertainty of outcomes, and, importantly, shortened product life cycles. Also, the sheer amount of scientific and technical knowledge required to develop certain complex products in today's world increasingly requires several firms to pool their resources. Moreover, the only way these firms can ever recover their huge investments in research and development is by selling not just to their national markets, which are too small, but to the whole wide world. And this also requires allies. This increased pressure for alliances, concludes Cobran, is one of the features of this era of globalization that is not only new in degree, but also new in kind. It is one of the features subtly knitting the world together and promoting more globalization in ways that are not always apparent. Alliances are not mergers. They involve two companies keeping distinct identities, but agreeing to work together in a very intimate way, and they are now forming all over the world at a pace never seen before. One place where alliances are most obvious to the naked eye is in the airline industry. Look at the ads for the Star Alliance, which is an alliance of six airlines to book seats on one another's flights through reservation code sharing and to honor one another's frequent flyer programs. This enables the member airlines, by partnering, to offer their customers one-stop shopping for travel anywhere on the globe. They know that in today's world, they have to be able to offer such service, but they can only do so through an alliance, because no one of them could possibly cover the world alone. Their ad shows an elongated airplane, in which the nose section is from United, the front cabin Air Canada, the midsection SAS, Varig, and Thai Airways, and the tail section Lufthansa, all next to the revealing headline, Star Alliance, the airline network for Earth. And now who's their competitor? Another airline alliance, of course. It's called One World, and its ads boast, now you can look forward to recognition on seven of the world's finest airlines, with access to even more lounges, smoother transfers, and the ability to earn and redeem frequent flyer miles to even more destinations. Having a CEO who knows how to forge and manage alliances to build trust and transparency with other companies is a critical asset for surviving in the globalization system. It can get very complicated. Compaq, by forging a strategic partnership with Intel to make its microprocessors, and with Microsoft to provide Windows operating systems and software, was able to immediately integrate the newest technological advances in both semiconductors and operating systems into each new computer to stay right at the cutting edge. Compaq's 1997 annual report stated that customers are increasingly recognizing that the best computing comes from the company that partners the best. Forbes once quoted a management consultant describing the relationship between Intel's Andy Grove and Compaq's Eckhard Pfeiffer this way. From Andy's mouth to Eckhard's ear, it's kind of like a marriage. As with companies, so with countries. In terms of economic security, America has always needed allies in the international economics realm. We have never been an island unto ourselves. We just need more allies now in more ways, at more times. I can't imagine that 20 or 25 years ago, my predecessors would have been worried about an economic crisis in Thailand or Indonesia or even Korea, former U.S. Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin said to me. England you worried about, Japan you worried about, but not Thailand. But today, so many more countries are part of what is, for practical purposes, considered the global economy. Their performances can affect our country, and it takes a lot of my time and energy to deal with the ramifications of that. On the national security side, many of the same pressures to find more partners and allies apply. These are part of what is, for practical purposes, considered the global economy. Their performances can affect our country, and it takes a lot of my time and energy to deal with the ramifications of that. On the national security side, many of the same pressures to find more partners and allies apply. For one thing, in the absence of an all-dominating Cold War with an all-threatening enemy, nobody's public wants to pay a heavy price in either blood or treasure to beat back the smaller rogues, even though they can be enormously dangerous. Even when a Saddam Hussein comes along, threatening oil routes and brandishing weapons of mass destruction, the Bush administration had to spend 6 months putting together a coalition of partners, not just to wage war on Saddam, but more important, to pay for it. I was covering Secretary of State Baker when he went out on his fundraising trip for the first Gulf War. All the reporters on the plane pitched in and bought him a tin cup. But besides needing more allies to face down the rogues, there are a whole host of transnational issues that are now more threatening than ever in a world without walls. When there are no walls to protect you, the only way to protect yourself from internal or external threats is by getting the quality of your own governance and oversight up, and by building alliances with others to do the same, whether it is to combat terrorists, the mafia, weapons proliferators, or El Nino. Throughout the late 1990s, the United States tried to get a weak Russian government to restrain the sales of nuclear and missile technology to Iran by private Russian companies. In the Cold War world of walls, the United States never had to worry about private Russian firms acting on their own. There was no such thing. There were just official Russian arms sales that could be deterred by the threat of official American arms transfers or by other state-to-state means. But this is not the case anymore. Russian arms manufacturers are now increasingly autonomous actors, desperate for cash. The United States cannot, on its own, impose export restrictions on private Russian companies. Instead, America has to try to create tacit walls against such exports by using its leverage to shape a coalition and try to get others in the public and private sector to join it. In the case of the Russian arms transfers to Iran, the Clinton administration imposed economic sanctions on a Russian university and two technical institutes, and then tried with mixed success to get the Europeans to do the same, because the Russian experts at these schools were suspected of working with Iran, and the Russian government would not or could not do anything about it. In the Cold War, America could stop such Russian transfers as a soloist. Now it can stop them only by acting like an orchestra conductor. That is why, in the system of globalization, the biggest challenge for American leadership is to sort out which problems it can still shape alone through classical state-to-state military deterrence, and which problems it can shape today only with partners. There are unilateralists in American politics who believe we should shape every issue alone. There are multilateralists who believe we should shape every issue with our allies, and those whom we want to become our adapters. The truth is, there has to be a combination of the two approaches. If America is not prepared to do certain things alone, no one will follow. But if it seems as though it wants to do everything alone, no one will follow either. Monsanto Chairman Robert Shapiro, whose company had to manage a lot of global strategic alliances with farmers, seed distributors, and food buyers in order to get the most value for its products, once talked to me about how complicated this can get. He sounded at times like the President of the United States, trying to figure out how America should shape the bailout of Mexico, or what coalition, if any, to use when confronting and containing Iraq. Shapiro said, This new world of alliances is terra incognita. Everyone has a model in their head, but no one knows how it works. How do you balance shared interests and self-interests, short-term gains and long-term gains? Where do you have things in common, and where do you really want to preserve separate identities? Mergers we know how to do, but alliances between equals are different. I have to count on your capabilities as an important part of my life, and the real challenge is that you are not going to just have one of these alliances. You are going to have a bunch going all at the same time if you're competing globally. And then it comes down to how do I make trade-offs between you and me, you and Fred and me? It's really complicated. How good is your country's or company's brand? In today's globalized world, both a powerful global economy and a powerful country need to have strong brands that can attract and hold consumers and investors. What is a brand name? A team from the McKinsey consulting firm defined it well in 1997 in their company's journal. A name becomes a brand, the McKinsey team wrote, when consumers associate it with a set of tangible or intangible benefits that they obtain from that product or service. As this association grows stronger, consumers' loyalty and willingness to pay a price premium increase. To build brand equity, a company needs to do two things. First, distinguish its product from others in the market. Second, align what it says about its brand in advertising and marketing with what it actually delivers. A relationship then develops between brand and customer. As the alignment grows stronger, so does the brand. In other words, to build a strong brand, a company has to demonstrate how relevant the particular strengths of its product are and how different they are from others. And brands are so much more important in today's globalization system because consumers and manufacturers are now meeting one another so much more directly in a world without walls or middlemen. When people can go online and buy whatever they want, rather than going to Saks, Sears, or Circuit City and having a store and salesperson mediate for them and help them choose, having a strong brand that conjures up a strong image with customers is essential. Compaq ran into a serious branding problem in the mid-1990s when, in effect, it got outbranded by its components and alliance partners, Intel and Microsoft. Consumers stopped caring very much about the box and whether it was called Dell, Gateway, HP, IBM, or Compaq. All they cared about was whether it had Intel microprocessors inside and ran Windows operating systems and software. No wonder Compaq executives started to grumble, "We're tired of being distributors for Andy Grove." One reason Compaq got outbranded by Intel and Microsoft was that it saw itself in a very limited way, and its advertisements reflected this. Compaq saw itself as a purely product-oriented company, a maker and marketer of computers. It made good computers, and its advertisements were little more than pictures of each one of its desktops, laptops, and servers. In June 1998, just after Compaq acquired Digital Equipment Corporation, it launched a new global campaign to rebrand itself. The strategy was to create a real bond between Compaq and its customers, from the smallest desktop buyer to the largest corporate or government user. It did this in three ways. First, by changing how it delivered its products. Compaq had always sold its computers through retail outlets and other third-party resellers. As a result, it did not have a direct relationship with most of its customers. So it moved instead to a hybrid distribution strategy, which would allow Compaq to do sales over the phone and over the Internet, as Dell did, in order to build its own direct partnership with customers. Second, it beefed up its customer technical service department, so anyone with a Compaq computer could call anytime from anywhere with any problem. whether it was related to the computer, the software, or the New York Times Sunday crossword puzzle, and a compact service representative would help them solve it. Lastly, Compaq redesigned its ad campaign to reinforce this new approach by publishing ads that evoked a feeling of partnership rather than displaying a product. Compaq bought a 12-page spread in the Wall Street Journal to unveil its new brand, and that 12-page spread did not include a single picture of a computer. Instead, it contained pictures like that on the final page, showing two little kids walking through the forest, hand in hand, above the logo, Compaq, Better Answers. Countries now face the same challenge vis-a-vis their customers in the global marketplace, the members of the electronic herd. Countries used to just brand for tourism, but that is not enough anymore. As we move into a world where everyone has the same hardware and everyone is being forced to get the same software to go with it, a country's brand and the unique bond it can build with its foreign investors becomes even more important. Think of Europe after the European Monetary Union is in place. Why would you put your factory in Italy rather than in Scotland? It may come down to the weather or the food or the fact that the Italian brand seems to evoke a little more fun, style, and pizzazz. My colleague Warren Hogue, the New York Times London bureau chief, captured Britain's efforts to rebrand itself into New Britain. In the newly rebranded Britain, Hogue wrote on November 12, 1997, "Out are scenes of village cricket, tea and scones, baronial castles, beef-eaters, grouse hunts on heathery moors, ceremonial celebrators in wigs and tights, tepid amber ale and Union Jacks fluttering triumphantly. In are images of pulsing telecommunications, global business transactions, information technologies, buccaneering entrepreneurs, bold architecture, cheeky advertising, daring fashion, Brit pop music, nightclubbing. Anything, in short, that is youthful, creative, and, in the word most uttered by the leaders of this updated land, modern." The style offensive is being undertaken by the new Labour government at the suggestion of Demos, a social policy research center close to Mr. Blair, which recommended last month that it was time to rebrand Britain as one of the world's pioneers rather than one of its museums. "I'm proud of my country's past, but I don't want to live in it," said Tony Blair. The British government tourist agency got it just right when it decided in 1997 to change the country's logo from Rule Britannia to Cool Britannia. A country can also tarnish its brand. Malaysia, in the 1990s, developed a wonderful brand image, that of a multi-ethnic Muslim state that was embracing the technological revolution and making its name synonymous with information technology, even building something called the Information Technology Super Corridor, a high-tech industrial park around Kuala Lumpur. But when the Asian currencies collapsed in the summer of 1997, and Prime Minister Mahathir went on his tirade, accusing the Jews, George Soros, and his own Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim of conspiring to wreck Malaysia's economy, he soiled the brand of Malaysia Inc. and undermined international confidence in his country. These days, every country has to care about its brand, and even the petty thieves understand that. John Bussey, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal, wrote a remarkable story, February 27, 1998, about what happened to him and his girlfriend when they got into a cab in Mexico City one night and were, in effect, kidnapped by the cab driver and some cohorts. "The fellow holding a gun to my head Saturday night in Mexico City had discovered I worked for a newspaper. We had been riding around in the taxi for an hour, me face down on the cab floor, he seated above me. An accomplice was sandwiched in the seat next to him, half sitting on my dinner guest, pinning her in place. "You work for an American newspaper?" the robber with the gun asked again. "Yes, I'm on a business trip from the U.S., I answered, wondering if this was a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe he didn't like journalists. Maybe he hated gringos. "Well," the man said, "don't write anything about what happened tonight. It would be embarrassing for my country." Embarrassing for my country? If these had been slightly different circumstances, if the barrel of the .45 hadn't been 3 inches from my head for the last hour, if the robbers hadn't emptied my wallet, taken my watch, and now been trying to crack my bank account with my ATM card, well, I might have found the thought endearing. A little national pride, a kind of patriotic World Cup enthusiasm. His heart belongs to Mexico. "No, don't worry," I assured our robber from the floor of the cab. "It's a business paper, stocks and bonds. Wouldn't be able to get a story like this into the paper. Just another robbery in Mexico." If Mexico were a stock... As more and more people start to realize that their country can actually choose prosperity if it puts the right policies in place, and as more and more people come to understand fully how other people, particularly successful nations, live, they are going to start asking why their own political management hasn't chosen prosperity. In the Cold War system, a lot of countries could get by on where they were and who they were. Egypt was hugely elevated in the Cold War by the fact that it was the pivotal state in the Middle East between Americans and Soviets, and later between Arab states and Israel. And it had a grand history and pyramids to boot. France was elevated in importance by its ability and willingness to maneuver between the United States and the Soviet Union. And it had an illustrious history to boot. In the globalization system, where you are doesn't matter much anymore. And it also doesn't matter who you were. While countries should be encouraged to preserve their culture and heritage, they can't ride on it. What matters now is what you are, and that depends on whether you make the choices for prosperity available in this system. Derek Shearer told me a useful story along these lines. In the mid-1990s, when he served as the U.S. ambassador to Finland, he was accompanied by his wife, Ruth Goldway, who served as mayor of Santa Monica in the 1980s and presided over that city's revitalization. One day, Ambassador Shearer and his wife went from Helsinki over to the great Russian city of St. Petersburg to meet with the city fathers, along with the U.S. Consul General there. Shearer said, "So we were meeting with the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg and the chief city planner and some other city officials at a dinner hosted by our consul general. And these city officials are going on and on about what a grand city St. Petersburg is and how it has all these great cultural offerings. But we had come in from the airport that day, and the road from the airport to town was so full of potholes you could barely drive on it. And we had been to the Hermitage Museum that day, and it was sad to see that the place was crumbling. None of the art was properly lit. It doesn't have a restaurant or a proper gift shop. The place was a mess. It may have a great history, but it could never compete today with other cities with great museums." Meanwhile, these Russian city officials were arguing over what to rename the streets. St. Petersburg had been Leningrad in the days of the Soviet Union, and the street names were all from the communist era. So Ruth says to them, "I have a small suggestion for you. Instead of arguing over what to name the streets, why don't you repair them?" They said, "You know, that's a good idea." Chapter 12. The Golden Arches Theory of Conflict Prevention. Every once in a while, when I am traveling abroad, I need to indulge in a burger and a bag of McDonald's French fries. For all I know, I have eaten McDonald's burgers and fries in more countries in the world than anyone, and I can testify that they all really do taste the same. But as I quarter-poundered my way around the world in recent years, I began to notice something intriguing. I don't know when the insight struck me. It was a bolt out of the blue that must have hit somewhere between the McDonald's in Tiananmen Square in Beijing, the McDonald's in Tahrir Square in Cairo, and the McDonald's off Zion Square in Jerusalem. And it was this. No two countries that both had McDonald's had fought a war against each other since each got its McDonald's. I'm not kidding. It was uncanny. Look at the Middle East. Israel had a kosher McDonald's. Saudi Arabia had McDonald's, which closed five times a day for Muslim prayer. Egypt had McDonald's, and both Lebanon and Jordan had become McDonald's countries. None of them have had a war since the Golden Arches went in. Where is the big threat of war in the Middle East today? Israel, Syria. Israel, Iran. And Israel, Iraq. Which three Middle East countries don't have McDonald's? Syria, Iran, and Iraq. I was intrigued enough by my own thesis to call McDonald's headquarters in Oak Brook, Illinois, and report it to them. They were intrigued enough by it to invite me to test it out on some of their international executives at Hamburger University, McDonald's in-house research and training facility. The McDonald's folks ran my model past all their international experts and confirmed that they, too, couldn't find an exception. I feared the exception would be the Falklands War, but Argentina didn't get its first McDonald's until 1986, 4 years after that war with Great Britain. Civil wars and border skirmishes don't count. McDonald's in Moscow, El Salvador, and Nicaragua served burgers to both sides in their respective civil wars. Armed with this data, I offered up the Golden Arches theory of conflict prevention, which stipulated that when a country reached the level of economic development where it had a middle class big enough to support a McDonald's network, it became a McDonald's country. And people in McDonald's countries didn't like to fight wars anymore. They preferred to wait in line for burgers. Others have made similar observations during previous long periods of peace and commerce, using somewhat more conventional metaphors. The French philosopher Montesquieu wrote in the 18th century that international trade had created an international Grand Republic, which was uniting all merchants and trading nations across boundaries, which would surely lock in a more peaceful world. In The Spirit of the Laws, he wrote that two nations who traffic with each other become reciprocally dependent, for if one has an interest in buying, the other has an interest in selling, and thus their union is founded on their mutual necessities. And in his chapter entitled How Commerce Broke Through the Barbarism of Europe, Montesquieu argued for his own Big Mac thesis. Happy it is for men that they are in a situation in which, though their passions prompt them to be wicked, it is nevertheless to their interest to be humane and virtuous. In the pre-World War I era of globalization, the British writer Norman Angell observed in his 1910 book, The Great Illusion, that the major Western industrial powers, America, Britain, Germany, and France, were losing their taste for war-making. How can modern life, with its overpowering proportion of industrial activities and its infinitesimal proportion of military, keep alive the instincts associated with war as against those developed by peace? With all the free trade and commercial links tying together major European powers in his day, Angell argued that it would be insane for them to go to war, because it would destroy both the winner and the loser. Montesquieu and Angell were actually right. Economic integration was making the cost of war much higher for both victor and vanquished, and any nation that chose to ignore that fact would be devastated. But their hope that this truth would somehow end geopolitics was wrong. Montesquieu and Angel, one might say, forgot their Thucydides. Thucydides wrote in his History of the Peloponnesian War that nations are moved to go to war for one of three reasons: honor, fear, and interest. And globalization, while it raises the costs of going to war for reasons of honor, fear, or interest, does not and cannot make any of these instincts obsolete. Not as long as the world is made of men, not machines, and not as long as olive trees still matter. The struggle for power, the pursuit of material and strategic interests, and the ever-present emotional tug of one's own olive tree continue even in a world of microchips, satellite phones, and the Internet. This book isn't called The Lexus and the Olive Tree for nothing. Despite globalization, people are still attached to their culture, their language, and a place called home. And they will sing for home, cry for home, fight for home, and die for home. Which is why globalization does not and will not end geopolitics. Let me repeat that for all the realists who read this book. Globalization does not end geopolitics, but it does affect it. The simple point I was trying to make, using McDonald's as a metaphor, is that today's version of globalization significantly raises the costs of countries using war as a means to pursue honor, react to fears, or advance their interests. What is new today, compared to when Montesquieu and even Angel were writing, is a difference in degree. Today's version of globalization, with its intensifying economic integration, digital integration, its ever-widening connectivity of individuals and nations, its spreading of capitalist values and networks to the remotest corners of the world, and its growing dependence on the golden straitjacket and the electronic herd, makes for a much stronger web of constraints on the foreign policy behavior of those nations which are plugged into the system. It both increases the incentives for not making war, and it increases the costs of going to war in more ways than in any previous era in modern history. But it can't guarantee that there will be no more wars. There will always be leaders and nations who, for good reasons and bad reasons, will resort to war. And some nations, such as North Korea, Iraq, or Iran, will choose to live outside the constraints of the system. Still, the bottom line is this. If in the previous era of globalization, nations in the system thought twice before trying to solve problems through warfare, in this era of globalization, they will think about it three times. Of course, no sooner did the first edition of this book come out, in April 1999, than 19 McDonald's-laden NATO countries undertook airstrikes against Yugoslavia, which also had McDonald's. Immediately, all sorts of commentators and reviewers began writing to say that this proved my McDonald's theory all wrong, and by implication, the notion that globalization would affect geopolitics. I was both amazed and amused by how much the Golden Arches theory had gotten around, and how intensely certain people wanted to prove it wrong. They were mostly realists and out-of-work cold warriors who insisted that politics and the never-ending struggle between nation-states were the immutable defining feature of international affairs, and they were both professionally and psychologically threatened by the idea that globalization and economic integration might actually influence geopolitics in some very new and fundamental ways. Many of these critics were particularly obsessed with the Balkans precisely because this old world saga in which politics, passion, and olive trees always takes precedence over economics and the Lexus is what they knew. They were so busy elevating the Balkans into a world historical issue, into the paradigm of what world politics is actually about, that they failed to notice just what an exception it was, and how, rather than spreading around the world, the Balkans was isolated by the world. They were so busy debating whether we were in 1917, 1929, or 1939 that they couldn't see that what was happening in 2000 might actually be something fundamentally new, something that doesn't end geopolitics, but influences and reshapes it in important ways. These critics, I find, are so busy dwelling on what happened yesterday and telling you what will happen someday that they have nothing to say about what is happening today. They are experts at extrapolating the future from the past while skipping over the present. It's not surprising this group would be threatened by the McDonald's argument, because if it were even half true, they would have to adapt their world views, or even worse, learn to look at the world differently and to bring economics, environment, markets, technology, the internet, and the whole globalization system more into their analyses of geopolitics. My first reaction to these critics was to defensively point out that NATO isn't a country, that the Kosovo War wasn't even a real war, and to the extent that it was a real war, it was an intervention by NATO into a civil war between Kosovo Serbs and Albanians. And I pointed out that when I posited my original McDonald's theory, I had qualified it in several important ways. The McDonald's theory didn't apply to civil wars. Because, I explained, globalization is going to sharpen civil wars within countries between localizers and globalizers, between those who eat the Big Mac and those who fear the Big Mac will eat them. Moreover, the theory was offered with a limited shelf life, because I said sooner or later, virtually every country would have McDonald's, and sooner or later, two of them would go to war. But I quickly realized that no one was interested in my caveats, the fine print, or the idea that McDonald's was simply a metaphor for a larger point about the impact of globalization on geopolitics. They just wanted to drive a stake through this Golden Arches theory. So the more I thought about the criticism, the more I told people, you know what, forget all the caveats and the fine print. Let's assume Kosovo is a real test. Let's see how the war ends. And when you look at how the war ended, you can see just how much the basic logic of the Golden Arches theory still applies. Here's why. As the Pentagon will tell you, air power alone brought the 1999 Kosovo War to a close in 78 days for one reason. Not because NATO made life impossible for the Serb troops in Kosovo. Indeed, the Serbian army ended up driving most of its armor out of Kosovo unscathed. No, this war ended in 78 days using air power alone because NATO made life miserable for the Serb civilians in Belgrade. Belgrade was a modern European city integrated with Western Europe, with a population that wanted to be part of today's main global trends, from the internet to economic development, which the presence of McDonald's symbolized. Once NATO turned out the lights in Belgrade and shut down the power grids and the economy, Belgrade citizens almost immediately demanded that President Slobodan Milosevic bring an end to the war, as did the residents of Yugoslavia's other major cities, because the air war forced a choice on them. Do you want to be part of Europe and the broad economic trends and opportunities in the world today? Or do you want to keep Kosovo and become an isolated, backward, tribal enclave? It's McDonald's or Kosovo. You can't have both. And the Serbian people chose McDonald's. Not only did NATO soldiers not want to die for Kosovo, neither did the Serbs of Belgrade. In the end, they wanted to be part of the world more than they wanted to be part of Kosovo. They wanted McDonald's reopened, much more than they wanted Kosovo reoccupied. They wanted to stand in line for burgers, much more than they wanted to stand in line for Kosovo. Air power alone couldn't work in Vietnam because of people who were already in the Stone Age couldn't be bombed back into it. But it could work in Belgrade because people who were integrated into Europe and the world could be bombed out of it. And when presented by NATO with the choice, your Lexus or your olive tree? they opted for the Lexus. So yes, there is now one exception to the Golden Arches theory, an exception that, in the end, only proves how powerful is the general rule. Kosovo proves just how much pressure even the most olive tree-hugging nationalist regimes can come under when the costs of their adventures and wars of choice are brought home to their people in the age of globalization. Because in a world where we all increasingly know how each other lives, where governments increasingly have to promise and deliver the same things, governments can ask their people to sacrifice only so much. When governments do things that make economic integration and a better lifestyle, symbolized by the presence of McDonald's, less possible, people in developed countries simply will not tolerate it for as long as they did in the past. Which is why countries in the system will now think three times before going to war, and those that don't will pay three times the price. So, let me slightly amend the Golden Arches theory in light of Kosovo and what are sure to be future Kosovos. I would restate it as follows. People in McDonald's countries don't like to fight wars anymore. They prefer to wait in line for burgers. And those leaders or countries which ignore that fact will pay a much, much higher price than they think. On July 8, 1999, USA Today ran a story from Belgrade that caught my eye. It was about the economic devastation visited on Yugoslavia as a result of the war. The story contained the following two paragraphs, which, had I written them myself, people would have insisted I made them up. Zoran Vukovic, 56, a bus driver in the city of Niš, earns the equivalent of $62 a month, less than half his salary before the war. The Serb government laid off almost half of the roughly 200 drivers last month. The rest had their salaries slashed. With the state controlling the price of food, Vukovic and his eight dependents can survive, but most extras are simply out of the question. McDonald's is now only a dream, says Vukovic, who used to take his three grandchildren to the Belgrade outlet. One day, maybe, everything will be okay. I just don't think it will be in my lifetime. You can actually grasp everything you need to know about the difference between how the Cold War system shaped geopolitics and how the globalization system shapes geopolitics by studying Albania. When Albania was engulfed in civil war in early 1997, I happened to be watching CNN to stay abreast of the story. CNN had no live footage from Albania, so it kept showing a map of the Adriatic Sea off the coast of Albania. On this map were little ships, each representing one of the American, European, and other countries' naval vessels that had rushed to evacuate their citizens from Albania. As I looked at that map, the first thought that occurred to me was that if this were still the Cold War, the ships on that map probably would have been U.S. and Soviet warships, each competing to see which one could fill the vacuum in Albania, which one could support their proxies there most effectively, and which one could pull the Albanian pawn the fastest onto their side of the Cold War chessboard. In short, the two superpowers would have been competing to see which could get into Albania the first, the farthest, and the deepest. But that is not what was happening on CNN that day. This was now the globalization system, and in this system, the different powers were actually competing to see which could get their people out of Albania the first, the farthest, and the fastest. The country that got its people out of Albania the first, the farthest, and the fastest was the winner in Albania. And the loser was the outside power that got stuck with responsibility for managing Albania, which turned out to be Italy. What is this telling us? It is telling us that the Cold War system was characterized by two fundamental features, the chessboard and the checkbook. That is, the Cold War system was dominated by two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, and they were engaged in a global competition for strategic advantage, resources, and honor, in which each side's gains were the other's losses, and every corner of the world was at stake, in play, and counted as much as any other corner. As Michael Mandelbaum put it,